You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Mike Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. We're here today in the studio with Thomas Sanchez, whose new novel, Mile Zero, has just come out from Alfred A. Knopf. His first novel was hailed as a masterpiece. It was called Rabbit Boss, and until recently, it has been out of print, just recently returned to print from Vintage. Mile Zero is a book that tries to encompass a great deal of recent American and post-American history, say. It's a book that Thomas Sanchez has lived with for 10 years. You describe the process of making the book as originally a conjuring. What do you mean by that?
Well, the conjuring of a novel has to do with not knowing so much how you will achieve the end of the journey, but knowing exactly where you want to end up, but not how you're going to get there. So that is the original conjuring, but you don't understand the magic of the language that will transport you to the finality.
It's kind of interesting because this book, a book of 10 years, reminds me in many ways of Under the Volcano, which is a book that grew very much by accretion. Draft after draft and galley after galley, Malcolm Lowry's biographer's report, would come back and still he'd want to do yet another draft of the book. Did this book prey on you and grow on you in that way?
Well, absolutely. As far as draft after draft is concerned and having an editor suggest or to mold or shape a novel, in particular this novel, that never happened. I worked on 10 years in Mile Zero with no one actually seeing it, so I did the editing myself. The opening paragraph was rewritten and rewritten over 500 times. Mile Zero was originally 1,000 pages long, and many sections were taken out in toto because, as you mentioned, over that 10-year period, it really grew and shaped its own self.
Right, developing the voices then for these sections, because it is, what would you say, a heteroclite novel, full of the voices of radio, the voice of movies is a scene toward the end of the novel that almost has to be imagined as a movie. Its literal imagination comes from movies. Creating a novel that's going to be a novel of pieces is going to have its worth by holding itself together at the seams. That's quite a risk. What involved it? How did it come about?
I agree with you. It is a risk, and I think that the glue of it really was the language. And I was very much like Claudius in Hamlet. I mean, I had in the beginning ideas and theories, but I was the opposite of Claudius, whose words were flying up and the thoughts remained below. What brought the words up for me was the language, and I didn't hear the language of the novel until almost 3 years after I began it. And that really became the glue, and that's what pushes and propels the novel forward, and also the reader. And that's why I whittled the language down. I mean, originally it was almost like creating a mountain of language and then finding the shape within, finding, for example, the figure in the carpet.
The novel is set in Key West. Do you regard this novel as being a voice of Key West?
No more than I think that Death in Venice is a voice of Venice. I think that Key West is a very fascinating place. I mean, it really is the literal end of the American road. It's the beginning and end of the American road. And if you're one of those who rattles down there and end up at this place called Mile Zero, which in Key West, if you drive to the end of the American road, there actually is a metal sign with a big zero on it with a mile above it. But if you are a Haitian refugee or a Cuban refugee coming to this country and escaping war and poverty in your own homeland, then you are at the beginning of the American dream. So really, Key West is used here metaphorically as a crossroads of America, both its past and its future and its potential.
It's very interesting. The thing that fascinated me about the book seemed to be that while it's full of Raymond Chandler-esque sentences, like she was a hot girl in a hot town looking for a hot time, the gods, the literary gods of the book, seem to be Pablo Neruda and the Spanish poet whose pronunciation
Gongora, yes,
known for a complicated and extended metaphor. But the characters in the book mm-hmm. are not necessarily literary people. It seems to be a book that is going to crack between the world of literature, the world of metaphor, and the actual world, the political world, the world of failure and disappointment. Did you feel, you know, writers often, William H. Gass, Malcolm Lowry, writers who are given to a thick verbal embroidery often kill themselves in the process of creating it. You know, it's something that cannot be recaptured, something that cannot take less than 10 years to do.
Well, I think that is really the gamble. And what you're speaking of there is that the novel is existing on two levels with its language. It's existing on the level of the teller of the tale, and then also on the level of involvement, which is a passionate immediacy and an emotional immediacy of the characters themselves. So you are aware that there is obviously a larger intelligence behind all of this, which is a net that's pulling tighter and tighter. As a matter of fact, I think in Mile Zero, it's probably around 3/4 of the way through that you sense that the strings have been pulled inside of a glass bottle, and you're beginning to see the ship pulled up that's been constructed within that bottle. That is the hermetically sealed world of the novel itself. And as a work of art, it must succeed or fail within that hermetically sealed world.
Is it possible that certain novels require that their writers break themselves? It seems to me everyone who knew him says that the Melville post-Moby Dick was not a healthy, not a smiling Melville. He begins writing Pierre saying, Sophia Hawthorne wrote a note saying, "Dear Herman Melville, I enjoyed your novel about the whale." Melville writes back saying, "Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I am preparing for my next book a fresh goblet of country cream." But Nathaniel, writing about how terrifying the book is, gets the answer from Melville, "Well, you have only met Leviathan. I am now preparing the Kraken, the beast so far under the sea that there's no getting back to the surface." Is this book in some way a rite of passage for you?
Well, it is, but I don't think that one consciously gets out of bed every morning and puts on and glues on feathers to his arms and flaps off towards the sun. I think that what we're really talking about here is more of a vocation rather than an obsession. I think if you have the obsession, you probably never will reach the end of your journey. When I was writing Rabbit Boss, my first novel, which took 7 years to write, and was over 100-year history, really, emotional as well as literal, of Washoe Indian tribe in California and Nevada, I recall very distinctly when I would think that in my dreams I would be thrashing around that in the day's work before I had betrayed a character by putting a comma in the wrong place. And I would awaken in the morning with a mouthful of blood from all of this gnashing of my teeth during the night and spit it out into a bowl. And I would see my own blood and I would say, "I'm really devouring myself both physically and mentally, trying to come to terms with a reality that is removed from my own." And you don't really know if you've been transported into another time or exactly what is happening to you when you're moving through that. I definitely was a different person and I had a feeling when I finished Rabbit Boss, and it really was prophetic, that in order to move to another novel, another novel that had the epic quality that Rabbit Boss had, and by that I mean is to construct a language which will allow a particular world to grow from within. And in order to accomplish that, I really felt it would take me as long to unwrite Rabbit Boss as it took me to write it before I could move into that kind of a novel again. And I actually, in 1980, took Rabbit Boss out of print, because you're saying something very, very important here, is that because I knew that in order to get to Mile Zero, I really, in a way, had to, and it was something that can be psychoanalyzed, but I don't need to do that for particular reasons. But in a way, I had to obliterate the ego that created Rabbit Boss, and that was an ego that gave itself up and over to a particular passion, and I had to bring back not only a passion, but a different language, and that was the most important thing.
Now, you grew up in Northern California, but more than growing up there, it seems that you inherit very much a part of the San Francisco Renaissance aesthetic. I think that you were friends with the Rex Roths, and you've mentioned
yes.
Jack Spicer earlier. The language that you're talking about, does it begin with that argot as bedrock?
That's really very interesting, because I came from a family of immigrants. I mean, my father was killed in the war before I was born, and from that side of the family, obviously no one had really gone beyond high school. The other side were Portuguese immigrants. One person in the entire family had gone to a low-level teacher's college, and I was like a fighter who grows up in the countryside and knows he wants to become a fighter, and so he goes to the big city to hang around the gyms to see the way the fighters handle themselves, mm-hmm. how they step through the ropes into the ring, and how they present themselves to the opponent and to the world. And I was very much like that. I wanted to be a writer. The city was San Francisco. My history was not, of course, you're talking about Mr. Melville and Mr. Hawthorne earlier. That came to me much later in life. But in the beginning, I really was much more of a Frank Norris kid. I was much more of a Jack London kid. I was much more of a Twain kid. And the Beats, in particular, Kerouac, was really an awareness of a particular kind of language that I didn't feel was innovative whatsoever. I felt, well, this is a language of this particular experience and where I happen to come from. So I arrived in San Francisco at a time when that kind of language was in the air, and I was not really a part of it as much as I was, almost what inspired it in a way. I think that there was a certain kind of a California youth that was so antithetically opposed, without understanding it, to what had gone before.
Mm-hmm.
And I represented that in a pure way, because when we talk about the Beats, there was a conscious distinction to really cut the past and the future. With me, I was unaware, really, that there was a literary past.
Almost as a floodgate, one year William Carlos Williams began a poem, "The Pure Products of America Go Crazy." And then it's almost as if the following generation's purely American literature, Kerouac, Ginsberg, the Beat Generation, is a product that begins with going crazy, that you have to go crazy first in order to get a pure language of America. Mm-hmm. Is that true for you?
Well, I think it is, in that I felt that the world that I was in the 1960s was a world gone crazy. As I mentioned, my father was killed before I was born, but obviously once you become educated, you realize that other people were still ice skating in Rockefeller Plaza. The world that I was in, the world of the 1960s, when I could see this war growing in Southeast Asia, and I questioned it very early on because I knew what the effect of war was, so it damn well better be one that you were fighting in order to protect your homeland, or else forget it. And obviously it wasn't that kind of a war. Those who first died in it were people that I grew up with and I loved. Those who first fought against it were people that I grew up with and I loved. So I think that the world was going crazy around me, and if you will, that's precisely what happened. And I was trying to decipher that world and make some sense of it.
It's interesting, because at first it seemed to me that there was a very interesting triumph. Perhaps for a long time it looked like the Vietnam War was going to be the first war without a literature, that if we had our way, those of us who hated it would refuse to dignify it with language, with memory. Did you feel that way at first, that this was a war that shouldn't be memorialized?
You put your finger on something so important. In the 1960s, when I knew that I was a writer and I was writing, it was a very unfashionable time for the word. It was a time when people were not only saying the novel is dead, but it was a time when it seemed that everyone else in the generation was picking up a guitar and plugging it in and amplifying their own personal angst. And if you picked up a pen and tried to do the same, you were somewhat of a buffoon and a laughing stock. I used to say to my students at San Francisco State University, where I taught very briefly in the 60s, and kind of the heat of the anti-war movement, and I realized I was coming close to standing behind a barricade waving a pistol at my own uncles. I used to say, if America was a burning house and you could save one thing from it, what would you save? And my answer to myself became that one thing from that culture that I wanted to save was the novel Rabbit Boss that I was working on. And this is what I felt, just it's such an appropriate question you just asked me, because I left America in 1969 to work on Rabbit Boss because it was the time we landed on the moon, and it was the time where every 30 minutes on the radio in the United States of America, they were broadcasting how many of theirs we had killed and how many of ours had been killed. We all knew that those numbers were being manipulated, but the cynicism beyond and behind that was even much more profound, because it had abstracted the war into almost a point where there was a spiritual anesthetic in the air. And I really felt that I wanted to save the language that I had to try to come to terms with not why we were in Vietnam, but how we got to Vietnam. And that's what Rabbit Boss was all about, even though it ends, Michael, 20 years before we are in Vietnam.
I'm talking to Thomas Sench, as author of Mile Zero, recently published by Alfred A. Knopf. Now, this novel, Mile Zero, has almost as a presupposition a Vietnam that has gone radioactive, that's subdivided so many times and reinjected itself into a culture centered around Key West, that this is the devolution of the Vietnam generation, and now poisonous flowers are blooming, planted in that the muck of that generation. Is it hard to imagine, then, an epic novel based upon cultural fragmentation?
Well, I think if we can't, there will be no novels left, because we are in a state of obvious cultural fragmentation. As a matter of fact, the character or creature that was Zobop in the novel, who was a New Age sorcerer, is precisely that. He is one who perceives fragmentation as the new wholeness. He is that most dangerous of creatures who has appointed himself as the judge, jury, and the one who is accountable. And he is saying that he is going to hold mankind accountable for its sins. So, and Zobop is very interesting, because he continually says, because you don't know your own history, you don't know who I am. And what he is the beast that is there. And that is what, in Mile Zero, the design of the beast is implicit. And it becomes a struggle for those that really can perceive this beast and go out to hunt it and to stop it.
It's interesting, because Zobop in a way reminded me of a piece written during the Depression called Ballad for Americans that had as its invisible speaker, it was sort of a cantata, a spirit of America whose refrain was, "And do you know who I am?" Eventually, he's the collective everybody put together. But Zobop seems like the collective everybody broken down. This very much seems to me to be a novel of, what, psychic breakdown and degeneration. Even in terms of its plotting, it seems to want to be a mystery at one moment, mm-hmm. but a mystery that won't have an answer at another. A movie with a climax at one moment, but a climax that doesn't have steps leading to it. It seems like one of those entirely eccentric structures that nevertheless self-supports. And it did seem to me, reading, that this book could only have shaped itself that way the course of shucking parts of itself off, rejecting things that had preceded.
That is very true. I mean, if you want to go to the moon, you don't build a bicycle. And I think once you're in the moon, if you want to get back to Earth, you really have to start discarding things so that you're not weighted down so much that you really can't get off the moon and get back into the stratosphere. And what is interesting about Mile Zero were those things that were discarded, as I mentioned, working on the Central American part of Mile Zero and discarding that after years and years of work. That was the great and really almost grand difficulty of trying to come to terms with the novel. But when you mention the cantata, I mean, we're going back. That's a word that Lorca mentions a lot. And one of the things that kept me from sort of slipping over the brink into really this absolute abyss, because I had no concept if I would ever finish this novel or what its final form would be, and you really don't until the very end, is every day I read like a breviary the poetry of Pablo Neruda, and more in particular, I would read Lorca, and that kind of that focusing of the laser that would finally come down so sharp metaphorically until it absolutely imploded into its subject matter.
A hard question to ask, but I think it's worth asking. You've expressed in other interviews the kind of tension that came after completing Rabbit Boss, feeling on top of the world but feeling at the same time like it was time to prepare the new one. Do you feel, having completed this book now, that you're at the beginning of another phase of depression and reconstitution?
Well, that's a question I ask myself every day. And when I went to France and I talked to my French publisher about Mile Zero, and he said he wanted to publish it, and then after hearing 7.5 hours of the story behind how it was written, and I walked to the door to leave, and he took a drag on his gavois, and he said, you know, he said, what you should do now, your next novel. And I said, what is that? He said, you should write a short, sweet, sentimental book. And, you know, there is a time for the flowers to come up. Whether or not those flowers are going to be poisoned or not is yet to be seen.
It's very nicely put. There is a temptation, frequently a conservative one, to try and create an American romantic or sentimental novel. I think John Gardner tries it in October Light. No, the book, in fact, is called Nickel Mountain. And the book creaks as you read it. You sense the absolute hypocrisy of the writer trying to write a sentimental novel as if there were no difficulty in doing so.
Oh, I think it's the most difficult thing to write and to accomplish, no question. And as a matter of fact, a quote from Zobop, love will kill us all.
I wondered if you would mind, if you have a passage, say, 5 minutes of Zobop that you could read for us.
Yes?
I've been warned that to ask you to do this, I've been told, will make me think that you need hospitalization. So I'm going to steel myself and listen.
Well, if you will allow me, we will go to Zobop, who is, at this point, your pen pal from hell, who is sending you poisoned letters. And this is from something called the Tiger Car Manuals, which Zobop, residing like a troll beneath the 7 Mile Bridge, is really has you in a room, and he is telling you all of your sins, and you want to go for the door. You do not want to stay in this room with this man at all any longer.
This is Thomas Sanchez reading from Mile Zero.
Enough, you shout. You aren't responsible for the earth's ills. So why can't I be generous and entertain you? Soothe your trembling hide. Coddle you like those alligators you've seen in Everglade tourist traps, where Indian boys wrestle reptilian creatures onto gnarly backs, then rub gator-white bellies with sand until angry snorts turn to snores as the ancient creatures drift off, webbed feet pawing the air as their powerful tails slacken, no longer threatening to break a man in two with a fierce swish. Off to Betty Bye-Bye you want to go. When you awaken fresh from dreams, I'll still be here, rubbing sand on your belly, rockabying your alibi in an amphibious limbo. I am not a dream. Does your hand feel moist? Is your mouth dry? Good. We can get down to business. I'll tell you my secret. Now that you have awakened from your stupor of two-bit Sims preaching over radio waves for sympathy from the devil. The devil doesn't need your guilt. The devil doesn't dish sympathy. The devil desires only souls. I know more about these things than those who are these things. I see the forest without the trees. I see myself in a suit of bones. I have become transparent, invisibly exposed, a vengeful skeleton stalking your island streets. I know by heart your childish songs of rock and roll. Mock and muck, incessant patter, mind stagnation, year after year. Will you never grow up? I am the walrus. I am him, and you are me, and we are them together. Woo-hoo! I am not part of your interminable childish present. I am not the walrus. I am not you. We are not together ever. You didn't know that? You don't know anything. But maybe this once you think you do. Maybe you think you really don't need me. It would be the end of you to think that. Finality. I must go now because I must put on my suit of skeletal lights, dance into the night, a naked snake in a top hat. Are you coming? I thought so. You who have been squeezing the rubbery shell of my hand so intently? Come then. We are off. What? What? You'll have to speak up. I can't hear you above the water roaring through my head. My secret? You want to come with me to learn my secret? Of course. When I discover the wrongdoers, their evil will bleed in the streets. Since you forget your present as well as your past, you need me to remind you of this fact. If there is one thing Zobop does, Zobop reminds with remembrance, avenges memory. Hold tight. Listen hard. You've got one last chance to escape before becoming like the hordes of pretenders who drifted to this island, south of the south, burning every bridge of hope behind, flying from home without ever leaving the ground, tumbling down to Land's End. Nowhere to go from here except to start swimming with sharks and barracuda. Southernmost point, it is called Mile Zero. Last hope. For star-crossed creatures dreaming in tropical pastures at the end of the American road. Last hope.
Thomas Sanchez reading from his new novel, Mile Zero, just published by Alfred Knopf. Thank you for being here with us, Tom. It was really nice to have you.
Thank you, Michael.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ices, no wind.
A second author was listed in the program guide for today. Judith Freeman will be heard on Bookworm on the 26th of February. That's after the subscription drive. You're listening to KCRW Santa Monica, a community service of Santa Monica College at 89.9 FM, National Public Radio for most of Southern California. KCRW thanks the Lemley Theaters for their support. Currently playing at the Royal in West Los Angeles, Camille Claudel. It's time for KCRW Playhouse and The Sound of Writing coming right up, and then The Lord of the Flies by William Golding, the next to the last episode today at 2:30.
Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Writing, America's only short story magazine of the air. I'm your host, Alan Schuss. We have three stories for you today, each of them dealing in its own way with the motif of fathers and sons.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.